You're listening to the Elmira Radio Hour, a podcast that opens the door to culture and news you definitely missed this week. We're your hosts, Nina Bhattacharya
and Sheila Lal.
If you're going to talk about a revolutionary situation, you have to have people who are physically able to wage revolution, who are physically able to organize.
This week, we're talking about the complicated politics of etiquette dinners, as well as food history and conflict and how they intersect. This episode was recorded prior to the horrific violence in Charlottesville, and Sheila and I want to reiterate that we stand in solidarity with our Black brothers and sisters and siblings who bear the burden of this violence. We recommend donating to the Black Lives Matter Fund in Boston, which has been doing incredible work following the Boston White Supremacy Rally, and has been bailing out many of those who were arrested during the powerful rally that occurred on Boston Commons. And you can find the link to donate at ucaring.com/fightsupremacy. That's ucaring.com/fightsupremacy. The way bail is set varies depending on individuals' context of arrest, prior history, and a couple other things. So any donation towards these efforts would help, especially since the march was incredibly, incredibly successful. In addition, you'll probably notice that the audio in this episode is a little wacky. This is because Sheila and I, due to technical difficulties, lost the original episode we recorded, and so managed to squeeze in a second recording on the way to work. But those caveats aside, let's get started.
So, I don't know if you can tell, but last night I did my voice in, but it's just a really loud bar, and to talk to anybody, you're just screaming. So I'm now drinking ginger honey hot water.
Aww. Like, sad and hilarious. Have you started recording?
Yeah.
Okay, cool. Yeah. So we can actually talk about, maybe this is a good time to talk about, what is socializing like when you're starting business school?
Yo, it's a lot. Well, that's the thing. There are 400 of us. So if you decide not to go out, very few people will notice. You have the option to stay in. The reason I've been going out almost every night is because I don't have any obligations right now. I don't have schoolwork. I don't have, like, clubs. I don't have to really start thinking about recruiting yet. And so I'm really using this opportunity to, like, get to know my classmates, even if it's in a passing manner. I at least recognize them, and that way I don't, like, call David Bob, you know? And so...
Which could be easy.
So
given
easy.
The fact that we discussed last night in our lost recording, which is why we are recording right now, is because we had technical difficulties that didn't record the episode we recorded. That you sat at a table with three dudes named Ian.
Yeah.
So it is important for you to get the sense of everyone.
Yeah, so that's one reason I'm going out a lot. I'm not drinking, like, I'm not going out and getting drunk because I want to be able to wake up and do stuff. But, like, it's interesting that there's a lot of drinking involved. And they'll say, oh, you don't have to drink, it's not required. And that nobody will really judge you. But I'm like, if you're at a bar, and everybody else is drinking, it's like the pressure is there. And so, like, one of my friends is not drinking currently because she's on Whole 30. So we got her a soda water with lime, and it wasn't a big deal. But she also did not stay out very long. And it's like, oh, if you're not drinking, you're not staying out. Yeah, that's basically, socializing sounds a lot like my voice right now in the morning. Well, then, of course, last night, before even going out, I had that etiquette dinner. And for the people in my cohort who didn't get to go, and it wasn't because it was closed off to certain folks, it was just a registration cap. And it was like, it was encouraged for all sorts of students, not just international, but domestic. I would just explain to them that I'd learned all of this in third grade when in Girl Scouts, and that like etiquette rules don't really die, but it was still like kind of a goofy experience. Like the
we talked a little bit about this before about the etiquette dinner. You know, like if that's the first time I actually have heard it, like a graduate school hosting an event like that, honestly, and that's also because I'm just like not attuned to what the Harvard Business School does here, since like the schools operate as separate entities here.
So their rationale for even hosting it is once you start recruiting or interviewing for jobs, you will be taken to fancy places. And so it's already like acknowledging that there is a massive class differentiator in business school. So like I would never have been in those spaces of very high-end fancy dinners with rich people. But they want you to be prepared and they want you to be able to code switch, essentially. Code switch in terms of class. And so I thought that was interesting, and it wasn't explicitly stated like that. And I just think that the way that they did it was not super explicit about why business culture should change. Like they say deals and jobs and access all happens over these dinners. And that to me is like this massive perpetuation of access and income inequality. And so I didn't feel yucky in terms of like the stuffiness of etiquette, but it did make me a little uncomfortable that we glossed over what does etiquette even mean? Who does it leave out? Like, why do we have to pretend to know it? And like, why is it that the people who are still there with a lot of influence and power dictating like an antiquated system of eating? Like, I understand good manners, but this rule about like how you pass, which direction you pass bread or how you do or don't eat salad is like, it's a weird form of like food policing.
Yeah, no, I agree completely. And it also makes me think about like, the schools that like hosting etiquette dinners for individuals who might be working with Indian or Japanese companies or Chinese companies where the rules of etiquette are so culturally different.
Yeah.
But maybe they should be doing that because the kind of global landscape of how of trade is just vastly different than, you know, even 10, 15 years ago. Like, why should it just be international students and people from different class backgrounds getting, you know, acclimatized or assimilated into, like, this one standard of Western etiquette? Like, you know what I'm saying?
Yeah, absolutely.
I'm not put off by the idea of like etiquette in general. It's just it's one kind of etiquette.
Yeah, for sure. And that was actually something that my table talked about. So we had participants from China, India, Nigeria, and the U.S. And it was really cool to learn about Nigeria and China, and like what's considered polite and what isn't. And like Bhavneet, the guy from India, and I were like talking back and forth and like clarifying stuff about Indian etiquette, because when people think about eating with your hands, they think about a very like exaggerated motion. And I'm like, no, it is an art. It is a skill. Like, you are not like being gross. You're not like licking your fingers in public. There's an art to it. Like, there's an art to chopsticks.
Exactly. Like, can you pair a roti with one hand?
Yeah.
Like, that's the etiquette. Like, can you share a piece of bread with one hand without using your hands?
Yeah.
honestly, that is a skill. Like, you see, even like having watched individuals who have not grown up using turkey to eat or even rice to eat, like, how do you get the right amount of everything in a hand and do it without spilling it all over yourself?
Exactly.
There is an art to it, but as you said, that people just don't realize.
Yeah, and then it's like, it's not seen as an art, it's seen as like this exotic experience. Or even the way that food is plated, whether it's a thali, like a North Indian thali, or like a banana leaf thali in the South, and what do different things look mean? And we had, Pamit and I had this like back and forth, a really good one about like the art and chemistry of Indian food and spices and balancing. And that to me is also part of etiquette. Like, how do you understand how to mix different flavor profiles?
Like, when do you take a little bit of matcha or pickle and mix it with your rice? Like, to balance the flavors of your dal or, like things like that. Yeah. So I would have loved to sit in on that conversation. And actually, this weekend, I'm, like, helping out at, like, a Hindu retreat for, like, teenagers. And one of the requirements is that, like, only simple food, no utensils, everything should be eaten with your hands. And, like, I'm actually really curious to watch, like, Indian-American high schoolers. I can't tell, like, either they'll be, like, really used to it, or it will be a pain, depending on what food is provided.
And so that actually, I didn't really get to talk to you too much about y'all progress, but one of the things that we did for our summit with high school, Asian American and Arab American high schoolers was have a radical food dinner. And so Connie and Rajiv made chole with a Korean red pepper paste. And I made dal and rice, and we brought it for these kids, and like a good like third of them were South Asian, so they knew what was going on. But it was really cool to watch them explain to their peers what everything was. And then we went around and told stories about what food has meant to us in different contexts. And like, because I'm a decade older than all of them, and so I said, yeah, when I was in high school, I used to bring leftovers, and my friends would steal, like, would eat my food. Because they liked it so much. I'm like, this isn't helpful, guys. Like, I need to eat my food. And then to hear that the multicultural, like, this innate, like, curiosity that isn't rooted in meanness is still there. Like, their friends will eat their food. And it's, like, nice to see, like, the diversity and history of our culture in food be shared amongst peers. And, like, in a small way, demystifying our existence.
No, it is. Like, I've been like absolutely in love with like any podcast, any article, anything that focuses on that intersection of like food and culture and like climate change.
Yeah.
And climate resilience. And like a lot of those stories are lost. Like, you know, I've been thinking like, what are the ate during partition, like as they were migrating.
Yeah.
What did they eat? What didn't they eat?
Yeah.
You know, like how did food patterns, you know, like food patterns shift when like our families immigrated to the United States just from the sheer like access or lack of access to like certain spices and vegetables in like the, you know, 60s, 70s, 80s. But, like, what did I mean when, like, different ethnic groups shifted from one area of India to another? Or, like, people from different ethnic backgrounds marry each other and their diets change. And, like, how does that kind of, like, also negotiate itself with kind of, like, the existing patriarchal structures? Like, in a lot of ways, like, my mom grew up vegetarian, and part of it was, like, family culture, part of it was, like, that was the closest socioeconomically sustainable thing for their family to do, for a large family. When she married my dad, like, Gary's involved here, like, once we have a vegetable, you have a doll, you have, like, a meat, whether it's fish or, like, something, you know? And that was, like, a good shift for their diet. In both instances, like, the things she knew how to cook, and then, like, the things that she would eat. She had to adapt to that in a lot of ways, you know? So, I've been thinking about that. And that's why I think it's so important for, like, it's almost like you guys had an intergenerational dialogue, even though we don't like to consider ourselves old. You know what I'm saying?
I also, when you're talking about migration and climate change, I like immediately think about that Sri Lankan cookbook, the Civil War cookbook that I got, and the whole point is like it documents Tamilian food in Sri Lanka, but the subtext is the war destroyed their culture, and this is literally the last culinary aspect of it, or like the culinary aspects that survived 30 years of forced migration and internal conflict, to put it lightly. And so then you reflect on why the food seems kind of basic or like not flavorful, and you're like, oh yeah, because who's carrying around spices when you're literally fleeing for your life? You have 20 minutes to get out.
Exactly.
And it's just like a very mellowing, like reflective book to read.
Wait, what's the title again?
I can't remember. Hold on one second.
I mean, it reminds me of a cookbook I have that is along the similar lines. It's called The Dapper Kitchen Cookbook.
Yeah.
And it really focuses on the different cuisines and dishes in the Dapper area. And it has chock full of interviews with aunties and fishermen and profiles about like how things have shifted during the Israeli occupation. Like in terms of, they used to have a lot more fish dishes back in the day when like guns and boats could go further out into the water. But now, like, as sea rights have been limited over time, you know, Palestinian fishermen can only go to like out to a certain depth. And that's a shallower depth. So that means they're not like that, those waters are pretty overfished, and they can't get like the bigger fish, you know?
Interesting, yeah.
And that has an impact on what's available and how people have had to adapt. But kind of along the similar lines to the cookbook I started studying.
Yeah, so this cookbook is called Handmade, and it's the organization that published it is called Palmera. And the person who founded it, the woman who founded it, is Sri Lankan Tamil. And so it was a way for her to document the stories of the Civil War and also revisit her own roots. And her family left the country after the 1983 riots in Colombo, or Black Friday is what it's called. And they moved to Australia, which has a very large diasporic community. And so she knew that she had like a market for this book besides people who've been there, or people who have a passing interest in food politics.
Definitely. I am also thinking this conversation about like kind of conflict and like history and food is reminding me of an article I read a couple of days ago, because you're asking me what were like the international things that are on my mind. And the first thing that actually had come up in my head, but I was a little shy about saying yesterday, was arepas in Venezuela. But like a lot of, you know, arepas used to be like a staple food for Venezuelans. But as the economy has crashed and the cost of goods has soared, the amount of arepas Venezuelans are consuming, who live in Venezuela, let's be clear, have diminished, whereas the popularity of arepas in the diaspora and like in other countries has soared. And then it made me think about this question of like, okay, conflict and economy and politics is shaping what people in a particular country see. If over time, like 10 years from now, arepas are no longer a staple diet of people who live in Venezuela, how authentic is that? is, does that diminish the quote-unquote authenticity of arepas in the diaspora to arepa places in the diaspora? Like, are they a historical artifact, like, at that point, and to a certain extent? You know, the way foods travel and don't travel, or exist and don't exist in their country of origin. I mean, authenticity is just a loaded word and, like, literally has no meaning anymore, but I was just kind of getting myself into this weird gobsmacked mind place where I was trying to, like, figure out, like, what does that mean? What if it means, like, arepas are... Okay. Do you understand what
I'm
saying?
I do. And I also think it's interesting because arepas are pre-Columbian. So they're before the start of the conquest. And so, like, they don't hold the original meaning or intent because most people who eat it aren't indigenous, like, fully indigenous. And so, like, in that case, has it already morphed? Have we already seen the evolution of its meaning and location? And so, as it gets popular in the diaspora, is it just another part of the evolution?
Oh, well, that's a really good point. I think that's what it is.
Yeah.
No, that's an important point. I feel, like, more resolved on this question now.
That's what I'm here for.
I'm gonna pop it.
Yeah, go for it.
I'm just going to hang out briefly, and I'm going to hop into my office.
Okay.
I'll be right back.
Okay.
Well, I was thinking on the elevator, since I hung up on you and went into my office, about, like, as you rightly pointed out, the arepa is then, like, another evolution of food. And what does it mean? But, like, what does it mean if we don't share or track down those food stories? Because then that history is lost. Like, if someone didn't know or have the story that, like, the arepa was a pre-Columbian food, then, like, we wouldn't know that it evolved to be a staple of a community's diet. And then we wouldn't know that, you know what I'm saying?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, so, like, I think that's really cool that you guys had a kind of this dinner with, this intergenerational dinner with young folks.
Yeah, it was super fun. We also got to trick them into caring about local politics and figuring out how to do it. Like, imagine 12 young people running around trying to figure out how to pass a bill and not having any idea. And they were like, oh, we don't know if we're doing it right. I'm like, that's exactly how people in the legislature feel. And their minds were blown. I also got to, we had them do this simulation between, like, different interest groups. So, like, are you party infrastructure? Are you an organization that goes between grassroots and other organizations? Are you grassroots energy? Are you organizations that only work within other organizations? Like, are you a candidate? Are you big money? Are you a voter? And we had them pick an issue, and they picked the defunding of Planned Parenthood. And they figured out how they all work together. Like, what is their internal strategy? How do they work with other people? Who are they not allowed to work with? I played the incumbent candidate and modeled it after my current senator in Missouri. And I was like, hey guys, why aren't you trying to talk to me? And they're like, why would we do that? I'm like, why wouldn't you? Why wouldn't you see if you can cut deals with me? And then I was, like, talking to the people who model themselves after Planned Parenthood, and was like, hey, if you guys stop running so many attacks against me, I'm going to do what I can as a Republican to massage, like, the attacks against you in the Senate. And they're like, okay, that sounds good. And I ended it with, you just got Kurt Schaefer'd, because that's what my former senator did to Planned Parenthood.
Oh, God. You got Kurt
Schaefer'd. And they were like, wait, I don't know what happened.
You're like, exactly.
Oh, so you posted that link on my wall yesterday about redlining in Michigan.
Yes, I thought it. I didn't get to read the full entire thing, but it struck me as an article that you would really, really be interested in, because it talks about how communities were historically described in Michigan, and how that interacts historically and present day with real estate prices and among many other things, right?
Yeah, and like this was a huge issue in St. Louis as well. I mean, throughout the country, anywhere that there was massive Black migration, you saw a lot of redlining.
Mm-hmm. Can you define redlining for people who might not know what that is?
Yeah, so redlining itself comes from using the color red on maps, like on geographic maps, to indicate which areas were either low income, had African American populations, or foreign populations. And it was a way to physically demarcate and segregate off where different populations were, quote unquote, undesirable populations. And how that was used in policy was saying, we are not going to give loans to people, house loans to people who live in these areas, in these red areas, or we're going to draw boundaries, like school district boundaries, around these red areas to keep them all together, but without explicitly saying that we're segregating.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So it perpetuates like lack of wealth accumulation and like the worse off school districts because of property taxes, because you can't actually buy your home because you can't get a loan, and all these other systemic social issues.
That is a really good summary. And this particular article, I was like, I don't have anything to add to it because that was succinct and to the point. But this particular article, which is published by The Bridge, which is actually something I think you should keep an eye on during your time in Michigan, Sheila. It's Bridge Magazine is kind of the news and analysis center for the Center for Michigan, and they like really do focus on solid evidence-based journalism. And they published 9 interactive maps that show how 9 Michigan cities were impacted by redlining in the 1930s. And so it includes cities like Battle Creek, Bay City, Detroit, Grand Rapids, Flint, Kalamazoo, Muskegon, Pontiac, Saginaw. And so these are both like a mix of places that are known to be like, have like large African-American communities like Flint and Detroit, but also mm-hmm. places that had a lot of industry, Bay City, for example, and like Dow, Pontiac, and Detroit and Flint, the auto industry, Battle Creek is Kellogg. You know, like there's a couple, like a lot of different business overlaps on this as well. It's really interesting to see. It's interesting to see how this is still so pervasive, you know?
Yeah.
Like, you can't undo years of, this overnight.
Yeah.
People, certain communities didn't have access to certain homeowners loans, period. And that shaped where people could buy houses or not buy houses. Like this is saying, this article was mentioning that in post-World War II, Blacks received just 2% of all loans, despite representing 10% of the population. I think you can even translate, especially in Flint, like you can translate how homeowners loans shaped where people were able to live in Flint to which communities were then affected by the Flint water crisis in the past few years. Like I can 250% predict that there is a connection between those two things in a lot of ways.
Yeah, I'm also thinking about how you're able to legally obtain justice through tort laws. And like Missouri, we just passed through, or the governor signed in Senate Bill 43, which would make it nearly impossible to sue based on discrimination. It's like how two words are changed in the human rights statute. But the guy who sponsored the bill in the Senate has, wait for it, a racial discrimination lawsuit against his own business based on redlining.
Hmm.
Yeah. Yeah.
Imagine that.
And so we're like folks with political power and the ability to even try retroactively fixing this just don't care.
Yeah, they just don't care. Because honestly, they're the ones who benefited from the redlining, typically. You know what I'm saying? Like, they're the ones
who
were, their families or, like, received loans during these time periods. They were able to buy houses in these communities. Like, it doesn't affect them.
Nina, those families that didn't get loans should just pull themselves up by their bootstraps and fallen right over.
Oh, my God. I don't have bootstraps. I'm wearing Tevas.
Well, I don't know if you saw that higher ed article about the origins of pull yourself up by your bootstraps.
No, I didn't.
So originally it was a tongue in cheek comment. It was like, if you pull yourself up by your bootstraps, you are going to fall over because your bootstraps are on your ankle.
Yeah.
So imagine like having straps to pull yourself up by, you fall over. You're like literally taking your legs out from under you.
So that's a false. Hey, so like if anyone's going to pull yourself up by your bootstraps, they're just telling me to like lay down on the ground essentially.
Yeah. Yeah.
Oh my God.
Yeah.
Why don't people know this?
Yeah, exactly. So it's like
the Lord's work, Sheila.
So this is like, I don't know. Redlining is really frustrating. I know people who will argue that businesses should be able to discriminate because they're like, oh, people who are being discriminated against can always go somewhere else. And I'm like, in what world does that make sense? Like, you are assuming that the folks who are discriminated against have access to money to start their own businesses. And then banks have actively been discriminating for decades. So the like whole idea that just like the market will fix itself is one of the stupidest arguments I've heard recently when it comes to discrimination.
I mean, if it's been a historically rigged market, how is it going to fix itself? Fix itself to what? What is the
equilibrium? Don't question the market.
I mean, and like the thing is with like the Michigan redlining that was in that article, it's like super explicit. And it wasn't just race too. It was like, it was even like class. It was religion. It was, and it literally said like, like I'm quoting here, Jewish and Negro, or mixed poor class, mostly laborers, Russian or Bohemian. The one for Flint that they had in there said undesirables, aliens and Negroes. That was in 1937. And think about it. I am reflecting on how that might reappear today. Like, how does I wonder if the like modern form of redlining will be a unfortunately against folks of refugee status, like based on immigration status, you know what I mean?
Yeah, they will, but also the Ann Arbor City Council passed through a language saying that they will support Iraqi refugees.
Which is really important. So for in Michigan, there's a lot of Iraqi Christian refugees who are like under threat of being deported, right? So the Chaldean community. And so that's important that the Ann Arbor City Council has done that. And I think immigration is really on the mind of folks in Ann Arbor, given that a woman who's lived in Michigan for 20 plus years, has a family and a home in the Ann Arbor area, was recently deported. And it's not without city council members fought for them, you know. But it's sanctuary city is a term that is like there's not like enforcement weight to it, you know.
Yeah, I was just saying that we acknowledge that we will try to do our best to keep you safe, but the law is, it supersedes, and we can't actually keep you safe.
Yeah, and I just thought that was heartbreaking.
Well, so I saw it at Skeeps, like they had the news on, and I'm in the middle of talking to people, and I start pointing at the TV because I was so excited. And I was like, I was yelling, this is why elections matter, because there was a city council race 2 days ago. And I'm like, and the only things I'd heard about the city council before that race were the former set of them or class passed through permissions for a high-rise developer to build out the parking lot by the library, like perpetuating issues of gentrification and class disparities.
Like, I would be really interested to continue getting your take on Ann Arbor city politics as your time there continues, because it's an area that prides itself on being progressive, quote unquote liberal, but those policies are often at odds with communities of color. And like we're seeing that here in Somerville and Cambridge as well. I mean, it's long been an issue, but they recently announced like a big market development in this neighborhood called Union Square in Somerville. And this is typically an area where they had a large Brazilian community in the past that has been slowly pushed out as rents have increased and so on. And this market development is supposed to be like, you know, it has supposed to have a brewery in it. It's supposed to have a lot of small shops. But like, what percentage of those are going to be owned by people of color, like people who have had businesses in that community for a long time, and Somerville is a community that does, you know, pride itself on being quote unquote progressive, quote unquote liberal. And so seeing this juxtaposition between like actions and ideals is something that I think we'll really have to grapple with.
So I was running, I've been training for the Detroit half and a half marathon, and I've been running through different parts of Ann Arbor. And every time I go into a much wealthier neighborhood with a lot of those, we support refugees, we're one human family signs, I'm just like, no, you're like, I guarantee you are a white person who doesn't actually have that many friends of color, or you like don't actually listen to them, and you're assuaging your guilt. Like, there are so few people I know who do the work who have those signs and who are white. And it's just like, it's just peak white liberalism. Like, your sign isn't going to save anybody.
And this is completely related to craftivism, making a craft from a kit that has a feminist message to it doesn't actually advance women's rights, for example, or trans rights or LGBTQ rights. It's important to be able to freely express that political message and feel comfortable wearing it. You know, like that saying that yard signs don't win elections, like it's kind of like that. Patches don't change policy. Oh, that's catchy.
I quickly wanted to talk about why elections matter. So I know we talked about this last night, but I still think it's really interesting and important. And yeah, it's still Michigan focused, but the Foxconn stuff is like still blowing my mind. And I talked to somebody last night who also had strong feelings about it. And I was like, why haven't we like yelled about this together? I don't get it. Like, you know that this is my forte, yelling about dumpster fire governors.
Oh, yes. So we're talking about Scott Walker, who's a human trash can.
Yeah.
Not to be confused with other human trash cans like Brownback.
Yes. I have to remember where I'm at all times and remember who the neighboring governors are. But Foxconn is this Chinese technology company that is most well known, for lack of a better phrase, for their work with the iPhone and Apple products. They have factories in China, and they treat their workers horrifically. There were a lot of stories about suicides, unfortunately, because of the treatment of workers. So Foxconn is one of the main users of special economic zones, which have been around for a really long time, but in the most modern iteration of them are used as a way to get different tax incentives or tax cuts or not having to adhere by environmental regulations or whatnot in order to, quote, promote economic vitality. And so what we've seen is this happening in China, but it's also been exported into parts of Africa, and we're now seeing it being exported into the U.S. So Governor Walker from Wisconsin announced that Foxconn was going to come through. Like, he had submitted a tax proposal, tax incentives to the legislature to try to get this factory into Wisconsin. And the problem with that is, like, Wisconsin and Michigan are along the Lake Michigan. They share a big water resource, and there's been a lot of effort to clean up that water and to actually value natural resources for what they are, which is a resource. And so Scott Walker's like, no, it's going to be fine. Like, there are going to be jobs, and that's what matters. What the AP reported was that the tax incentives would take 40 years to be bought or to be balanced out in the budget, which is fucking insane. 40 years for a company.
And yeah, for a single company.
And exactly.
It's interesting that Walker's touting bringing more jobs, because we are all well aware that, like, he doesn't have a good track record with ensuring labor justice.
Nope.
Like, with the right to work initiatives and things like that in the state. And so that's also one level. It's like, what kind of jobs are you actually willing to bring to Wisconsin? Like, just jobs where people aren't paid well or treated well or have health benefits? Like, what kind of jobs are those jobs?
Exactly. And so so luckily, the Wisconsin Senate voted down the incentives package. So I don't know what's going to happen next. Mm-hmm. But I just thought that that legislative process was interesting. And then on the other hand, Snyder, Governor Snyder of Michigan, announced that he was trying to get Foxconn to come to Michigan and
another
open up or expand.
Another human trash can. Okay. You know how much money he spent in his own defense against the, like, Flint water crisis? He spent millions of dollars on that, or at least hundreds
Holy
of thousands fuck. Of dollars.
I didn't realize.
Of state money in...
That's still a lot.
In defending. Yeah, it's just, no, it's bonkers. It's bonkers insane. And I'm glaring at any human who did vote in Snyder for governor. Sorry, Dad. I'm outing you. Like, but like, a lot of people did vote for him who were, like, moderate Democrats because he ran on, like, a business, more business-oriented platform, and would be supposedly quiet on social issues.
Yeah.
Neither of those things have been true. So
can't trust these hoes.
Can't
hoes meaning Republicans.
Them. Like, Rick Snyder couldn't even win his hometown of Ann Arbor. Just, let's be clear. So, like, what does it mean when you can't even win your hometown? Anyway.
So Snyder announced that he wants to expand Foxconn in Michigan. And that Foxconn wants to build a factory for self-driving cars, which, if you've been paying attention to that whole trend, that definitely has, like, some relationship to the University of Michigan, mm-hmm. whether it's the Dearborn campus or the Ann Arbor campus. And bigger picture, it's another one of those economic deregulation or environmental deregulation issues. Michigan has been doing such a good job and really putting to the forefront the importance of cleanup and water cleanup, soil cleanup, and trying to really live up to its slogan, Pure Michigan. Mm-hmm. Like Debbie Stabenow, one of Michigan's governor, or sorry, senators, has been drawing down money from DC, so federal funding for cleanup. There's been a lot of grassroots initiative. There's been a lot of grassroots education on the impact of agricultural waste and needing to clean up agricultural land. And to be like, hey, JK, we really don't care about any of this. And we're going to, like, let a factory or company ignore all of these rules. Just, to me, is optically really, really bad.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
I mean, politically, we know that people are garbage and they'll do that anyways.
And just from the sheer fact that I strongly believe that, like, the Great Lakes and, like, the natural resources that are available in, like, the upper Midwest mean a lot to people on both sides of the aisle. Summers in Michigan, summers in Minnesota, summers in Wisconsin are not the same without, like, being able to go camping and, like, up north and taking advantage of lakes and, you know, fishing and swimming and being outside. And those are only things that happen when we take care of those resources. So I think that's actually, the more I think about it, it is something that is a bipartisan issue. And at least in Michigan, on the cleanup thing, it has really been a focus. Even before Flint, there was the Kalamazoo River oil spill that happened in... it was like 2010-ish, I think. Yeah, 2009 or 2010. It's been taking years. It's taken years to clean up the aftermath of that mess. Just to undo all of that with a single welcoming of a single company. For what?
Yeah.
And I also, like, I'm not 100% sure if, like, those are necessarily the kind of jobs that Michigan should be soliciting, like, moving forward. I don't know if that's, like, sustainable.
It isn't. Well, it really isn't. There was a CNBC report that came out 2 months ago talking about Missouri, saying, like, jobs, like, businesses could move there, but people don't want to live there. And it's because we've dismantled so many protections for the sake of business that you can't you can't operate a business because the labor just can't be there, like literally cannot live there. And so I don't think that by continuing to dismantle workers' rights, we're actually doing anybody any favors. Well, obviously labor, we're not doing any favors, but we're not doing business any favors either.
Yeah. I mean, as we were discussing yesterday, like the most compelling argument I've heard for integrating labor justice into business policies came from Senator Cory Booker, who was on another round recently talking about, he was on the campaign trail with Hillary, was in Iowa, they were at a restaurant, and they're chatting with the waitress who had to come to work even when she was sick. And he said, his point after like narrating, you know, this very political vignette was, the system is incentivized as such where people who are sick are touching your food. They have to come into work when they are ill, and when they are ill, they have germs, and they are making your food. And I thought that was like an incredibly persuasive, perhaps selfish rationale for someone to support labor rights. You should support people's paid time off. You should support a fair wage. So sick individuals don't have to feel like they have to come into work to make the food that you're going to eat, which could make you sick.
Yeah.
You know, like that's just sort of the sheer public health.
Well, yeah. And also like from a selfish point of view, like if you're sick and you don't have sick days, you're just perpetuating the cycle.
Exactly.
So speaking of business, I got to go to business school. I got to head over to the business school right now. But I thank you for being patient with my technology woes.
No, that's fine.
Yeah.
It was good to chat with you, and I think we covered a lot of different ground, but like wonderful.
Yeah, ground. Good ground.
Good
yeah.
ground today. And I have to do some work.
Yeah, okay. I'll see you around. Okay. Bye. Bye.
Well, that's our episode. Thanks for hanging in there with all of our technological difficulties this week. You can find us on Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, your favorite podcast app at Almira Radio. And you can check out our brand new spanking website, which is super lovely and I absolutely adore it, almiraradiohour.com. We'll catch you soon.